From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past weekend when the New York State Legislature passed an on-time state budget. Governor Andrew Cuomo called it one of the best budgets of his tenure. Assembly Leader Carl Hastie told WXXI's Karen DeWitt that the budget wasn't all that great. But hey, it was done. And so what was in it? Well, here's something that was not in it, a so-called ultra-millionaires tax. Democrats ultimately decided not to include several proposed taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. And we're saying Democrats decided that because that's really who's in charge in Albany. Now, some critics are calling this a missed opportunity, citing polling that a majority of Americans support some form of tax increase on the richest Americans. Kind of depends on what question you ask and what specific proposal, but generally speaking, and Politico found this 2 months ago, Americans will support higher taxes on the richest Americans. Democratic leaders have said this budget promotes growth while taking steps toward tax fairness. Republicans, of course, don't like the budget very much at all, but at least they're satisfied that Democrats killed the ultra-millionaires tax. Now, this hour, a conversation about funding priorities, what voters want, what they don't want, and what tax fairness looks like if we're going to get toward the funding priorities of what government should and should not do. Our guests include, with us in studio, Jeremy Cooney is a former chief of staff for the city of Rochester and a recent Democratic candidate for the New York State Senate. Jeremy, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us is John Kalia, who is an executive coach, author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul, and a former member of the Democrat and Chronicle editorial board. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
And also with us is Michael Kink on the line with us, who is the executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Michael, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, Evan, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm surprised to hear you're good because I saw your thread on Twitter. You didn't seem very happy with this budget at all. And so I'm going to let you sort of open the floor by saying, you know, what stands out to you and why you thought it was a missed opportunity.
Sure. You know, Albany lawmakers put forward a budget that was fairly mainstream. Governor Cuomo patted himself on the back about it because it fits his political brand. It's moderate. Kind of continues New York down the path that we've been going. To us, it's a missed opportunity because there's been an explosion of wealth and income at the very top. Billionaires and multimillionaires, mainly in Manhattan, got huge tax breaks under the Trump Republican tax law that passed last year. And tax fairness suggests that we could reasonably take a modest amount of that money to invest in things that everyone in the entire state needs and relies on. This budget did not move the needle on education funding, fairness and equity for low-income, low-wealth school districts. This budget didn't do anything to reduce our record levels of homelessness and child poverty. There are things that we could have done that would have invested in our state and moved it forward, and not a single one of them would have required new taxes on working people. So the idea that all Democrats should be scared of all taxes and that all Republicans reject all taxes is just flat out untrue. As you mentioned, recent public polling and recent, you know, courageous conversations from high-profile elected officials like Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have demonstrated that we can do more. Government can do better. Government can improve our public schools, can create jobs, can deal with the climate crisis, can even reduce taxes for working people who in many cases pay higher tax rates than these billionaires and millionaires. But you've got to have the courage to reform and update our tax laws, and that's something that Governor Cuomo and Albany lawmakers didn't demonstrate this week in Albany.
Jeremy Cooney, would you have voted for this budget had you won your election?
I would have, and let me tell you why. I think we probably, sitting around this table, have more in common than we have less in common, because I do believe that this is a moment in time for us to have that courageous courage that you spoke about, Michael. I would also say that there's a lot of really interesting advancements on the social policy side in this kind of tucked in this New York budget like they always have that are worth talking about in just a second. But I also want to just take a step back and say, what is a budget, right? A budget is an expression of priorities at a moment in time. And in this moment in time, we have to realize that there's a lot of pressures and a lot of whacking, if you say, on different economic classes based on the federal tax and the SALT deduction and a lot of wonky type stuff. And so what I believe this legislative body did, or the Democratic supermajority, as you said earlier, Evan, did, is they looked at all the different factors playing in on these populations and they said, okay, we can't do X, Y, and Z, but we can do A, B, and C. And while we are still open to X, Y, and Z, we cannot do that in light of, for example, the cap on SALT taxes under the Trump tax plan. So I think that is what they're keeping a creative mind open for. Is there a missed opportunity? I don't think that we can tax our way out of a problem. I think that we often, especially as Democrats, and again, I agree with what Michael said before, you know, we get characterized as Democrats just want to tax. And that's not true. But I do think that we need to look at the other side of the equation, right? We always talk about the revenue side of the equation. What about the expense side of the equation? And Democrats have a real opportunity to take a hard look at some of those factors like health care and issues that matter most to Democrats on the social welfare side and look at and reevaluate how we could do better in administering state services on that level.
All right. We'll get back to some of those tangential issues Jeremy talked about in just a minute. John Kalia, your job is not to wonkily identify every line of a budget, but having written for the Democrat and Chronicle editorial board and sort of observing and blogging and writing yourself, I'm curious to know, generally speaking, how you see what has come out of Albany so far.
Well, I'm not a fan of anything that comes out of Albany, to be honest. And I would suggest that this whole issue of fairness is contentious, to say the least. And I wonder who it is that should decide what is fair. I'm not sure what panel of angels we can assemble to really put that in the right context. I also think you have to look at New York taxes in particular in the context of the federal burden as well as the fact that we're competing for citizens, if you will, and jobs with other states. New York has the highest tax burden in the country. Tom DiNapoli yesterday released a report that said that this is not really a 2% increase, but rather a 4% increase. If you look at Florida, for example, Florida has 1.75 million more people than New York, but its budget is only $88 billion compared to $175.5 for New York. So if you sort of look at it from a 50,000-foot level, there's something wrong structurally in the way we tax our citizens. And there's something wrong when so many of our citizens are leaving the state. New York, there was a U.S. Census Bureau report last year that reported that from July of 2017 to July of 2018, New York lost 48,000 citizens. And that was more than the next seven states combined. And why are they leaving? I mean, they're leaving because this is a state that's inhospitable to jobs. Taxes are a disincentive. And if you want to disincent, for example, burning fossil fuels or smoking, you want to tax those things. There's no reason we should be disincenting people from making money.
Okay. Let me just follow up with John on an important point here, because I heard Jeremy Cooney say he thinks that there's probably more agreement among the panel, even though, technically speaking, if you were to create sort of like a political graph, they'd be in slightly different places, all three of our guests here, which I think is a good and healthy thing here for the purposes of this conversation. But where there might be agreement is sort of peeled back in some of the polling. Jeremy's saying many workers want lower taxes. Michael is saying many working people ought to not be bearing the burden, particularly if the wealthiest have loopholes that workers don't have. Do you find any agreement there? Perhaps with Michael King, start there. And when we talk about the workers bearing a kind of a tax burden that he sees the mega earners often finding loopholes around, John.
Well, there's a question of degree, certainly. And if you look at, for example, middle class people, an additional tax burden sometimes is so great that they can't afford to live in their house. But I think the larger context here is that we as a state demand certain services. In fact, we take them for granted. And governing, we're told often, is about choosing. And the choices that our elected representatives make determine the context within which we all function. It's sort of the social contract of living in New York versus living in other states. So certainly, every dollar of the state budget is precious to someone. But those who would suggest that we should maintain a certain level of service only at the expense of the wealthy seemed somewhat sanctimonious to me, to be honest. I mean, if you think about it this way, if you want services, you should be able to, you should be willing to pay for them. And that should go to people almost at all levels of income, although I would certainly not favor taxing folks who are in the bottom half or the bottom 40%.
All right, I've got to let Michael Kink jump back only because John used the word sanctimonious. Michael, that's probably not the – that Michael Kink, I'm sure that's not the first time someone's leveled that charge at you, so I'm sure
well,
you've heard
that. You know, I agree with John that tax burdens can make people up and leave. The fact is that's not happening with millionaires. We have 72% more millionaires than we did when we started the millionaire tax in 2009. And the people who are suffering under the tax burden in New York are generally working people and seniors, right? I agree with Jeremy that there is room in this budget to reduce spending. We spend between $8 and $9 billion on corporate subsidies and corporate welfare, much of which is wasted, much of which goes to companies that don't create the jobs that they promised to create. And this budget flaked out on even making the basic facts of those subsidies available to the public in an online database. So there's a lot that's wrong with Albany, and I do think that tax policy is part of public policy that is part of what lawmakers are elected to work out. If you take tax policy off the table, there's no way you can deal with economic fairness, and there's no way you can actually improve the future of New York. Our economy is out of whack. It is wildly out of whack. New York City is growing by leaps and bounds at the very, very high end. The global rich are buying 25, 50, 100, $238 million apartments. And the economic growth, the benefits of all the things that companies in New York are doing is going extraordinarily quickly to the very, very top. So that is something that public policy can go after. We can make our tax policies more fair to reduce taxes on working people, right? We have a legitimate property tax crisis in our state. It was created when George Pataki and Joe Bruno and Sheldon Silver cut taxes for the rich, pushed a lot of money to Manhattan, and increased the cost of government on counties, which then drove up property taxes all over the state. There's a lot of other drivers, but that was the main one. We can go back. We can provide property tax rebates to seniors, to people on, you know, limited incomes, to folks that are working hard and can't afford to stay in their homes. And we can fund that with taxes on the super wealthy in Manhattan who are doing better than anybody else, right? This is something that could be politically popular, could actually help a lot of people in our state.
So, Michael, I want to follow up with two questions for you, and I want all of our guests to kind of grapple with them, because I, as I see them, there's one on a question of how you view what is either fair or moral, and as John Kalia said, the dicey game of trying to create some sense of what fairness is, but that's probably part of government's job to at least make some sort of a determination there. And then the question of the functionality of what happens if, let's just say, Albany had passed the ultra-millionaire's tax and the various other taxes you wanted to see passed that did not get passed in this budget. So first of all, when we talk about a $1 million or a $10 million or a $50 million apartment in New York City, Michael, do you think that is immoral? And number two, if we passed these taxes, do you think that it would have the effect of lessening the burden on most workers while not having some of the highest earners actually leave? That, in other words, that they're bluffing and that we're not going to see that. How would you address both of those?
Yeah, I mean, me personally, my personal kind of ethics and value system, I do think it's obscene when a hedge fund manager in Chicago buys a $238 million apartment just for himself, and we have 89,000 homeless people in New York, right? I've worked on anti-poverty and anti-homeless efforts my entire public career, and I just think that that's wrong. The academic studies demonstrate that super wealthy people don't migrate from state to state based on adjustments in marginal income taxes. Cristobal Young is a professor now at Cornell. He used to be at Stanford. Good job, Cornell, on getting him. He is the primary academic. If you go to his website, cristobalyoung.org or .com, I'm not quite sure. I'll pull it up for you. You can show the studies that you can see the studies that demonstrate that people do not flee based on modest adjustments in state tax rates. They build their companies and their businesses where they're successful, or they inherit their wealth, right? There's a lot of people in New York that are rich because their parents were rich and their grandparents were rich. Generational wealth is getting bigger and bigger as a portion of folks' income. So if we did the ultra-millionaires tax, if we did this pied-à-terre tax on the second and third and fourth and fifth homes of the global ultra-rich, we'd have enough money to put about $1.5 billion into our public school systems everywhere in the state and about $1.5 billion into property tax rebates that could actually reduce people's property taxes. So I think tax fairness is important in public policy. I agree with you, Evan. It's part of what government is responsible to doing. So a lot of the fights we have around the Capitol in Albany boil down to some level of morality and ethics. What's the right thing to do? What's fair? And at this point, so much of public policy at the state level benefits a tiny, tiny few, and it doesn't benefit the vast majority of people. That's what we're talking about. It's small d democracy.
Jeremy Cooney, is there something immoral about those multimillion-dollar apartments in New York City? And had these taxes passed, do you agree or disagree with Michael Kink that it wouldn't really have had the effect of chasing the wealthiest citizens out of this state?
Every time I come on this show, you ask me a capitalist question, Evan.
Well, that's sort of the deal right now. That's sort of the conversation.
So I would say that, look, people have the right to spend their money how they spend it. That being said, I do support these taxes on this ultra, ultra rich small segment, the pied-à-terre tax, which Senator Hoylman brought up in part of the budget negotiation, would provide a reoccurring fee based on second home ownership. And again, this is for that ultra rich population who does not pay state tax, property taxes already because they live in other states. And that would generate, I think, around $375 million on an annual basis, which could go to some of the priorities that Michael mentioned before, education, healthcare, et cetera. But I want to take a moment and just go back to an earlier point that was said about tax policy in general. Tax policy is a reflection of our values. And so let's take a very hyper-local issue here in Rochester, which I think can make this this point for me. Anyone who knows me and anyone who heard me on the campaign trail knew that I really am passionate about education, education funding, and education fairness, whether we're talking about the city school district where I graduated from or whether we're talking about some of our suburban school districts. I do support the tax cap, the 2% tax cap that the governor was pushing for, because I do believe that property taxes have got out of control. That being said, I do not support a tax cap at the expense of underfunding social contract programs like education. And so zooming into the town of Brighton, for example, Brighton, which is in the 56th Senate District, is woefully underfunded when it comes to education. They are, based on the education formula aid, they are getting less than half of what they are owed for education funding from the state of New York. And if that was the case for everyone, that'd be fine. But there are about 261 other school districts across New York State that are fully funded. And so what we're finding is that there is a mismatch and there's not equity in how those tax dollars are being dispersed through the state budget process, and I have great concerns about that.
Can I ask you just one more quick yes or no, though? Because the joke I have in this program is if someone dodges a question, I call them a senator because I'm just used to senators. But you ran for senator, and
yes,
you may be a senator in the future, so I'm not going to call you senator. So I'm just going to say, Jeremy,
okay,
do you think, yes or no, if these taxes had passed, would we see wealthy New Yorkers flee this state?
I don't believe so because I believe Manhattan is special. So the pied-à-terre tax was really based in New York City, the five boroughs. And those are areas where business leaders need to be to conduct their operations. But this is also a cultural center of the world. So I believe that Manhattan is uniquely special in that regard.
Okay.
And let me know one thing, Evan. There is not a single person in Jeremy's 56th Senate District that would pay the ultra-millionaires tax. There's 295,247 people in that district, and not one of them makes more than $5 million every year. So this is a tax that would provide benefits to the district without taxing anybody in the district.
Okay. John Kalia, do you think there is anything immoral about having a $50 million apartment in New York City? And do you think, are you worried that these kind of taxes would have a sort of a deleterious unintended consequence?
Well, let me start with the first thing first. No, I don't think it's immoral. It's not immoral to have money. It's not immoral to make money. It's not immoral to have thousands of times more money than anyone else. That in and of itself does not make one immoral. We certainly have seen episodes, if you will, or examples of people who have a lot of money doing egregious things. But it's not money that corrupts people, it's power. And it doesn't matter whether it's corporate power or government power. And in this state, we have a government that aggregates power, a governor in particular who aggregates power by taxing at extreme levels and then deciding how to distribute that money. And you could call that a moral argument or an expression of people's values, but from my perspective, the way in which we contribute to the economy should be a reflection of our values rather than the way in which the state taxes us and redistributes our income. So when I hear words like obscene and immoral in the context of fairness, what I think we're doing is characterizing the engine of our prosperity as something that's evil. And I really object to that characterization. I also think we need to look at the budget in the context of what we're spending and how we're spending it. There's a number of examples. I'll just pick on a couple. There was recently an opinion piece written by a gentleman named Paul Wettenhall in the Rochester Beacon. Paul came here in 1975 and worked for Xerox, and about 15 years ago moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where he took a job in economic development. And he provided quite a contrast between North Carolina and here. In the time frame that we're talking about here, from 1975 to today, Rochester area population grew from 1 million to, say, 1.1 million, something in that on that order, where Charlotte grew from 1 million people to about 2.5 million people. And it did so by attracting jobs. And his observation as an economic development professional is that there's a partnership between business and government, whereas here it's a battle. And it's a battle because we take so much money out of the economy and then create criteria by which the communities can get that money back in some way. And we compete for it in some cases. So if you want to talk about something that's immoral, that's what I think is immoral about the way New York is governed.
All right, so let me just follow up, because I do suspect Michael King's got something to say to that. And I also want to kind of get back to some of the points that Governor Cuomo has made at various points, not the least of which is after he soundly defeated Cynthia Nixon when she was running on a lot of these platforms, and what the governor has to say about sort of the political dynamic and what voters want. But we'll get back to that in just a second. When we look at sort of, I know you're comparing what, Rochester and Charlotte, John? Is that
yes,
right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, the contention being you grow from 1 million to 1.1 and 1 million to 2.5 in jobs and sort of a partnership as opposed to an adversarial relationship with government and business. But for those 2.5 million and for the people who are working in that region, are the wages, you know, are wages good? Is quality of life good? Are you comfortable saying that just because there was growth there, it was the kind of growth that should be sustainable and championed in our society?
Well, anybody that's been to Charlotte recently would probably agree that it seems pretty healthy. And what you're dealing with is a lot of young professionals, and the Census Bureau report that was cited in Wettenhall's essay would support that. And anecdotally, you know, I have a great nephew who went to school down there and decided to stay there, and his I wouldn't say fiance, not yet anyway, but his girlfriend moved there from West Virginia just because, and took a job there just because she wanted to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. On a grander scale, the census data supports the idea that a lot of young professionals are moving to Charlotte because it's an attractive place to live and work. So I think that's that's part of it. I'm not sure if I have any data at my fingertips on the larger scale issues of, you know, where there's poverty and where there's other social injustices. And I certainly, I think there's probably overlap between my view of that and our other guest's view of that in terms of how we should be caring for our least fortunate people. I just think there are larger issues with respect to how New York is spending money.
All right, Michael Kink, go ahead.
Yeah, and I would agree with both John and Jeremy. There's a lot of shared overlap here between the three of us, and I appreciate the interesting conversation. You know, a really interesting thing about North Carolina is that North Carolina adopted the model that helped build New York's prosperity and ran it during the period that John's talking about, just as New York started to abandon that model. During the period from the 70s to the current date, North Carolina, over a series of state gubernatorial and legislative regimes, invested in public education, invested tremendously in higher education, built resources from the ground up that benefited all North Carolinians. It's very easy to compare tax rates. You know, part of the deal here is Rochester was being attacked by capitalism, unionization, deindustrialization, offshoring, just as North Carolina was the subject of investment from capitalism, a right-to-work state. Part of the point that you raised, Evan, about the fairness in North Carolina is absolutely true. There is a broader low-wage base, but, you know, freaking upstate New York has a broad set of low-wage workers as well. So people are struggling everywhere. I would argue that the interesting comparison for North Carolina is that they built a world-class public university system. They built world-class public schools. At the same time that New York was de-investing in our public universities and our public schools under the kind of, you know, conservative, neoconservative, neoliberal, whatever kind of label you want to put on it, era of the late Mario Cuomo administrations, the Pataki administration, we have not kept up our investment as states like North Carolina have invested. And I think the North Carolina model is different than other kind of race to the bottom states like Florida or Alabama. You know, many of these states in the South did invest in their public university systems and their public education, and they had further to go. But I think that's what we're arguing now, that taking resources that are available from non-confiscatory taxation. There's a lot of public policy folks out there arguing for super high tax rates on the very wealthy. That is not on the table in Albany. What we're asking for is, a partial percentage point on income for the super wealthy who just got trillions of dollars worth of tax breaks from Trump, right? We are not talking about setting their apartments on fire and taking all their money. We are talking about public policy that could provide billions of dollars to invest on the grassroots level that can build our economy everywhere in the state. And I think that's a smart thing to do, and I think that's a fair thing to do.
So, Jeremy Cooney, why did Democrats not pass some of the measures that people like Michael Kink wanted?
So I think the elephant in the room when in talking about this budget is campaign finance. And I think, you know, the influence that money has in Albany in generally, whether it's perceived or reality, is that too much money, special interests, whether you talk about real estate or lawyers groups, professional groups, right? They have too much influence into the lawmakers' offices. And so campaign finance is a really, really important conversation about making the elections process and representative process more open to everyday citizens and to have new voices come to the table. As you know, that was kind of sidetracked in the budget process. The campaign finance conversation was relegated to a panel that's going to come up with some parameters in the future sometime. And a lot of the progressives were upset by that outcome in the budget process. But I don't think you can look at these two issues, taxation and campaign finance, separately. They really are tied together.
But again, why do they have to be tied? Why can't we do them separately, Jeremy?
Well, I think, you know, there is going to be an influence of money when it comes to, again, those special interest groups that have a lot of resources and energy. We were talking before the program started about the role that lobbyists have when making laws and creating the laws that are enforced, and they have an interest in doing so. And lawmakers listen to those individuals, and that's where I think the campaign finance conversation pops in. But if Evan, if I could just go back to a point that was made earlier by both Michael and John, which is really the competitive nature and the population loss. When we talk about population loss in New York State, we are talking about an upstate population loss, right? New York City continues to grow and its surrounding suburbs continue to grow. But where we're seeing a population decrease is right here in upstate New York, the southern tier, the North Country specifically. And a year from now, we're going to be going through the census process. And we're going to probably, most people say, we're probably going to lose a congressional representative after that census process because of a population loss in New York State. I believe the same conversation we had a few weeks back about the Amazon deal, about remaining, keeping New York competitive when attracting businesses to New York, the same thing applies for citizens. We need to be more competitive when attracting citizens, especially when trying to attract young people and folks who have moved out of upstate New York to come back home.
And so are Democrats doing that, you think? Does this budget do that?
I think we need to do more.
Okay, so I've got to get our only break in, and I know there's a lot more to get to. And when it comes to some feedback from listeners, we've got some interesting emails. In fact, I'll read this, and then we're going to go to break, and I'll give our guests some time to sink in with this. Tim in Pittsford writes to us to say, I'm not sure where Jeremy got his definition of a budget is. The verbatim definition is an estimate of income and expenditure for a set period of time. That's it. Why do we continue to think and include social issues that then get written into law as part of our budget? That's not what the formulation of the budget is supposed to do. We pay our representatives to go to Albany to advocate on our behalf and either work with or fight off others for our benefit. Instead, three or four people meet in a room, basically in secret, come up with a budget that happens to include a bunch of social issues that will become law instead of openly arguing these issues in an open setting like all of us as common citizens want. And Tim says, and by the way, yes, I am a liberal, but my wife and I are going to leave this state when we retire in 15 years due to taxes. That is from Tim, writing from Pittsford. Well, we'll let Jeremy and all of our guests answer that question, because Jeremy did mention that in this budget, there's always some things that sort of either included much more with much more fanfare or sometimes with less so. Jeremy Cooney is former chief of staff for the city of Rochester and a recent Democratic candidate for New York State Senate. John Kalia is in studio with us, a former member of the Democrat and Chronicle editorial board. He's an executive coach and author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. Michael Kink is executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. More of your feedback as we talk about the New York State budget, taxes, and more next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the difference between parody and satire. We're going to talk about Saturday Night Live and other popular shows that use comedy to make points at times, but most of what we're seeing, is it parody or is it satire? And does one work better than the other? Is SNL funny or is it lazy? We'll discuss all of that and more next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Jeremy Cooney, Tim in Pittsford, says he's a liberal who's probably going to leave the state in 15 years, and he doesn't know why social issues end up as part of a budget. Well, you kind of touched on that at the outset of the hour, so how would you address his question there?
So first of all, Tim, I'm sad to hear that you want to leave the state. I think your sentiment is shared by many, and I think we need to do a better job of reassuring your confidence in the direction that we're going to go. But let me just clarify what I meant by budget. When you said a budget is an estimation of revenue and expenses over a specified period of time, of course, that is correct. But those expenses and those revenue choices are indicative of priorities, and I think that's what I meant by what I said there. So let me get to the issue about taxation and population loss. You know, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, you know, people are upset and feel that they're being pushed and pressured out of this community, and we have to do a better job of changing that narrative. Everyone knows that our property taxes are some of the highest in the country. My friends down on Long Island will tell you that they're the highest in the free world. But that doesn't mean that we don't have excellent services. And I think that's something that John talked about earlier, is, you know, how do we balance the needs for services with the limited revenues that we have? I mean, this is back to the basic economic concept of scarcity, right? It's about making choices with limited resources. And so my take on this is that as a Democrat and with a Democratic supermajority, if you will, in Albany, we have to do a better job to reflect the values of what those choices are in the budget process. I do not think that we should have a budget process like we currently do, which includes outside policy items. Some states, for example, don't allow that. I was actually talking to a friend this morning who's from St. Louis. And in Missouri, they don't allow the budget to take on social issues or policy issues that are not related to a financial line item in the budget, in their budget bill. We throw everything in. We call it the big ugly, right? That's the phrase in Albany, because everything gets thrown in the pot. I don't think that's the right way of doing it. You've read all the articles about, you know, items coming up for budget discussion at 2:45 in the morning. Ridiculous. You know, we could do better. And again, it goes back to that reassuring our citizens that we're doing an effective job of governing, so that it's not just tax with no outcome for programs. Okay. No accountability.
And John Kalia, you said, you're not surprised to hear Tim saying, even though as a liberal, he may leave the state in 15 years.
I'm not surprised at all. And I confess to you on the break that my wife and I have talked about it as well. And we moved here from Florida 6 years ago. We've lived in five other states together. And when you move around the country, you get an opportunity to really contrast the culture in different states. We moved back here because we love this community. So if we're forced for economic reasons to leave this community and go back from whence we came, so to speak, we'll be very disappointed.
So, Michael Kink, if I could ask you then to sort of offer what I assume is your rejoinder to that, which is, if government in this state passed both the policies, the overarching vision that you had, I think you're arguing this would be a place that workers would want to come to, not leave, even though the perception that some have is that would be harder in terms of taxes, et cetera. So can you make the argument that this is a way to actually set New York apart and make it a place for workers?
Absolutely. And I think that's part of what people running for public office, if Jeremy takes another shot at the Senate, other folks that are running, need to make it clear that we can use tax policies to deal with the wild inequalities of the economy. We have this winner-take-all economy where all the wealth, all the benefits, all the growth is going to the very, very top. And that's happening in New York. It's happening in every other state. That big dynamic in New York, we have more billionaires than any other state. It is possible for us to ask them to pay their fair share, to invest in tax reduction, in public education, in higher education, and in affordable housing that can benefit people all over the state, right? I've got young sons. They're trying to figure out where they're going to work in the future. They find places like New York City and San Francisco insane, out of control, unaffordable. And at some level, just not places where they want to build a future. And I think that places like upstate New York could have a very, very, very vibrant future in the era of climate change, in the era of smaller scale business and agriculture, right? There's a lot of people that are rediscovering the values of what folks have in upstate New York, but they need good public schools. They need strong public universities. They need affordability. Basic affordability. And, you know, the right wing did a great job, like, slashing and burning the Democrats on taxes for decades, right? But what Pataki and Silver and Bruno did was they claimed credit for cutting taxes when their tax cuts benefited mainly the rich folks in New York City. And then they continued state government's expenses, but push more of it onto the counties. That's all the unfunded mandates we hear about. Unfunded mandates are a real thing, and a lot of them got bigger and more unfunded under the Republican regime in Albany that was patting itself on the back for cutting taxes. Most people don't have this. They have the soundbite of Democrats raise taxes and Republicans cut taxes. But if it were clear, like most folks know, that Trump tax cuts were massive tax cuts and a giveaway to the rich and big corporations, that we can reverse that in New York, that we could have economic fairness and tax fairness, and we could use that to invest in public goods that benefit everybody and some tax relief for the people that are hardest pressed, I think that would be good public policy and it would be good politics. It's a good way forward.
All right, so I want to do a couple things, and I'm already nervous we're going to lose the hour before we get to everything I'd like to talk about. I got an email from a listener named Peter with a 336 area code. That's Charlotte. So Peter says, he says, Evan, I moved to New York, North Carolina from New York over 20 years ago and then moved back to Rochester a decade ago. Comparing the two states in growth has many, many more factors than just taxes. As said, education was some of it. So too were incentives for banking headquarters technology, but also retirement. New York State has much stronger employee protections and other benefits that North Carolina residents don't enjoy as much. Neither are wrong, just different and more complex than comparing apples to apples. Great show today. That's from Peter. Fair enough. I mean, I take the point. Then the question becomes, what's more valuable to you sort of as a population? So Peter, thank you for that. But I want to ask, in particular, I want to ask about something that looks a little dissonant on its face, which is a couple of polls. First of all, right now the face of a movement that, whether it's a tax for those making $10 million or more, 70% marginal rates, of course, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and public polling finds that's pretty popular. It also, public polling finds, 61% of Americans favor Elizabeth Warren's proposal. Senator Warren's proposal is for a, quote, wealth tax, which would increase taxes on those with a net worth of $50 million or more. So it depends on how you word it. But the bottom line is, if you ask a general question, do you support raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans, 76% of registered voters say yes. And then it sort of becomes more interesting proposal by proposal. So there's a couple of things. I kind of want to ask John what you make of the fact that most Americans will say, yes, we want that. But then I want to ask Michael in particular, if that's the case, how come Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's favorability ratings are underwater right now? So, John, what do you make of polling that shows a support for higher taxes on the wealthiest?
Well, I'm tempted to introduce that word sanctimonious again, but I'll resist the impulse. I think people like to get things for free. You know, what we've seen is that historically, over the last couple of decades, that Americans prefer to have about a half a billion to $1 trillion more government than they're willing to pay for. And this is just another example of, sliding down that slippery slope. You know, I think what we need to do as community leaders is call attention to the moral hazard of that.
Okay. And so you see most Americans are obviously not super wealthy. And if you say, hey, tax the other guys, you think people are going to say yes. But is it possible that Americans also see that a lot of the super wealthy are born into their wealth, mm-hmm. didn't necessarily work on it. Mm-hmm. They simply have the sort of the luck of birth on their side. And there's something that feels unjust there.
Well, here's where I see it. I don't understand the impulse to tax somebody just because they're wealthy, or to tax people in Manhattan who own property there just because they won't leave. I don't see the logic of that. In principle, I'm opposed to taxing beyond what the government needs to run the government. You know, now the debate, there's a healthy debate all the time about what should be constituted in that. Again, I just sort of look at it and say, all right, you know, when does the word fairness cross over to grand theft?
All right, Michael Kink, the person in Washington and the person whose face is leading the movement on some of this stuff is Ocasio-Cortez, and the representative's approval ratings in terms of public polling in this state, they're underwater. How is that?
Well, any time that three or four or five Fox News shows are running a flaming publicity campaign to attack you, your public opinion polling is going to go down. AOC is the bête noire of the right wing for a very good reason. She's saying it clearly, she's saying directly, and she's connecting with the American public. And what we're talking about here is fairness, right? People should pay their fair share of taxes. The tinge of sanctimoniousness I'm hearing at times in the conversation about people want something for nothing. A lot of working people are paying their fair share. They're paying income taxes. They're paying sales taxes. They're paying property taxes. The wealthy just got the biggest tax cut in American history from Trump and Congress. They backed a Brinks truck up to the Treasury and drove it down to Park Avenue and spread it out on the streets, and they're rolling around in cash. That is unfair. That is, yes, obscene. And I think tax policy at the state level can respond to that, and it should.
Jeremy Kuhn, I already see John Clay. I'll just let our listeners know. He's shaking his head at that. Jeremy Kuhn, where are you on that?
So I think what AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has successfully done and has reminded Democrats that the issues that they should be focused around is income inequality. And if you focus on income inequality, all the social policies that build off of that are really what are the crux of the Democratic platform today. So I'm not going to speak to her polling, but I do think she's been successful at raising those issues, which have been kind of long been forgotten by my friends in the Democratic Party. And I think we're coming back to a conversation around income. But back to the budget conversation today, for me, what this is telling me is we have to do a better job. We in government, we as potential candidates, we as citizens need to do a better job of explaining and understanding the value that government has and what the services that are being provided for in the budget are actually doing. When I was at City Hall, I can tell you that people never wanted to raise city taxes, but don't you dare close a library a day early, right? And there's a mismatch there, right? You don't want to pay city taxes, but you want the services that the city has to offer. The same thing can apply at the state level. And so we have to do a better job of ensuring that the services that are being offered to the state are trickling down at the county level. We're going to hear a lot about this year, Evan, in the county executive's race, that the services that the county of Monroe is administering are done in a transparent and fair way. And I think that this all is interconnected to how are we communicating and what are the values that we're purporting to.
So let me keep it tight, Mike. Go ahead.
Totally. I would say what people want are public goods that are really strong and attractive. They want parks. They want libraries. They want opportunities to be in public with older people and younger people and families and kids together. Those are the kinds of things that get cut when we are pushing all this wealth to the very top and a small number of people are enjoying luxuries in their private lives when the rest of us are starved for resources that could help all of us live the kind of common, you know, enjoyable life that folks want. I think young people want that. And if we had a different kind of economy, we might have a different kind of tax discussion. But the economy we have now pushes all the money to the top, and we've got to find a way to deal with it.
All right, so let's start to close the program with this. When Governor Cuomo ran his primary against Cynthia Nixon, she ran on many of these ideas. He beat her soundly, and then said that he thought Ocasio-Cortez and sort of that idea of the moment was not really reflective of the hard work, the work under the fingernails, the governing, the compromising that happens in Albany at the state level all the time. The governor said then the voters understand that. They reflected it in their choice in the primary. His budget, really the Democrats' budget coming out of Albany this week, reflects that they don't fully they're not fully on board with some of that leftward movement, if you want to put it on a paradigm. And the governor says, you know, sort of the pragmatists do have a point here, that we have to govern, that it isn't just get everything that you want all the time. And I wonder if all of you can offer some thoughts on that. John, do you agree with the governor there?
I think he raises some good points, and I think it's fair to say that AOC has garnered a lot of attention and represents a certain segment of the population, but it's also fair to say that she is rather to the extreme. There's recently a nonprofit group calling itself More in Common that did some extensive polling that's been quoted in the press, and they estimate that 85 to 88% of the population falls into a category called the exhausted majority. Tired of what they're hearing from both extremes and tired of a dysfunctional government that can't seem to operate in a pragmatic way. So to the extent that, you know, we can keep that in mind as we talk about these issues, I think it's important. I think it's also important, you know, if we start to look at sort of the national taxation system, to remember that the United States has the most progressive tax system in the OECD. The upper half of the income strata, the upper 10%, pay a higher percentage of their income to the federal government than any other nation in the OECD. So when we talk about these things, I think you also have to put it in that context. We don't have a VAT here, which is highly regressive.
All right, I've got to keep it tight. About 30 seconds. Final thoughts from you. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Keep watching. In the past, when the Republicans controlled one of the houses of state government, they had to all the Democrats' power was to put everything they had into the budget. Now the Democrats control all three houses of government and state government. So there's a lot more to come before the session closes in June. We're going to talk about legalizing recreational marijuana. We're going to talk about health care for all. These are the issues that usually are confined to a budget conversation. Now they're expanded in the next couple of weeks to come.
So we're going
to
see a lot more.
A lot more to come. And you know what? I'm hopeful that the Democrats are going to step up and use their newfound power to bring voice to those issues.
All right. And Michael King, 30 seconds, final thoughts from you.
Anyone that is pushing for public policy changes that make a difference in today's economy are going to have to talk about tax fairness. Whether they're challenging Cuomo or challenging AOC, they're going to have to demonstrate benefits for regular people. And there is no other way to get money other than from the very, very, very rich.
Michael Kink is the Executive Director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Thanks for making the time for the program today, Michael.
Thanks, Evan.
Jeremy Cooney, former Chief of Staff for the City of Rochester, recent Democratic candidate for New York State Senate. Always nice having you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And always nice having John Kalia, an executive coach and author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. Thank you, John.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.